All right, it is June 29th, 2006, and I'm David Brooks, the interviewer for the University of Montana's Oral History Project. This afternoon, I'm talking with Rustem Madura. And I guess, Mr. Madura, what I'd like for you to start with is just some of your personal and educational background and your road or path to coming to the University of Montana and Missoula.
I was born and raised in India, and I came for graduate work to the University of Rhode Island, where I got my PhD in 1966. I arrived in Rhode Island in 1961, so I've been in North America since then. Off and on, I've made trips abroad. But I did my bachelor's and master's at the University of Gujarat, which is on the western side of India. And after doing my master's, I taught for a year or so and left for the University of Rhode Island, where a famous pharmacognosist used to be the professor and dean of the Department of Pharmacognosy. And pharmacognosy is nothing else but a study of drugs obtained from natural sources, which is my specialty. After finishing my graduate work at Rhode Island, while I had still not officially received the degree, I was hired by Idaho State University in 1965 to teach pharmacognosy there, while a fellow by the name of Frank Cole was on sabbatical leave somewhere in Egypt. So I taught pharmacognosy at Idaho State, and because my tenure was only for 1 year, I started looking around and was accepted as a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Nebraska and McGill University in Canada, in Montreal. The letter from Montreal arrived first, and I accepted it. And then in a couple of weeks, I received a letter from Nebraska asking me to go to Nebraska. And I would have been just as happy to go to Nebraska. But I spent 1.5 years doing postdoctoral work at McGill University in Montreal, where my first child, my son, was born. And then while we were at Idaho, prior to that, when we were at Idaho, we toured around the Northwest a little bit by car and fell in love with Montana. So I wrote to the dean asking if there was a position available when I was about to leave Idaho. And the dean said that they're looking for a guy like me, but the money had not been approved yet. Mm-hmm. So off I went to Montreal, and then after almost 1.5 years, I get a letter from the dean at that time, Dean Robert Van Horn, who said, would you care to come for an interview to Missoula, Montana? And so I flew in from Montreal in 1966 for an interview in February, I believe, and was pleased with what I heard, and of course I was already in love with the area. Mm-hmm. So when I got back, there was a telephone message waiting for me that the dean and the faculty had accepted me as a new faculty member to the University of Montana. So without much ado, I accepted the position and was to arrive here in September of 1967 to start the fall semester. But being a foreigner at that time, still changing my status from a student to a working class individual, I had to get a visa to enter the US. And the visa process took forever. at which point I started making inquiries, and I was told in Montreal by the consulate that they had no papers for me that I had submitted in order to get a visa. They had lost my papers somewhere in the shuffle. So I started all over again. And by the time I reached here, it was November 23rd, as a matter of fact, November 23rd, 1967, when I arrived through a snowstorm, and crossing Butte was hazardous at that on that day. It was about a foot deep of snow, and in those days the roads were not as good as they are now. So that was my first experience coming to Missoula. It also happened to be, I believe, Thanksgiving Day.
Mm-hmm.
So
and that you were was my interest. Yourself?
Sorry?
You were driving?
I was driving myself with a little baby and my wife. Baby, my son was 4 months old,
mm-hmm.
or 3 months old, yeah.
That's quite a welcome.
Yeah, that was quite a typical Montana welcome, not that it fazed me any.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, coming from India and having been in the university system there, and then coming to North America and seeing both Rhode Island, Idaho State, Montreal, University of Montana. Tell me what it was like when you first came as a university compared to either other North American universities or the university system you're used to in India.
Of course, the curriculum was quite different. But I was already introduced to the curriculum while I was in Rhode Island, and then again I taught some in Idaho, so I had a pretty good idea of the curriculum. The laboratory classes in India, like in Europe and England, are more intensive. And they do a lot of laboratory work even now compared to what we do out here in the United States. And in those days, the laboratory exercises were important because we used to make our own drugs. We used to dispense and compound our own medications compared to the pills and injectables that you get from pharmaceutical companies these days. So a hands-on approach was very important. And I was a little surprised and shocked that the hands-on approach was minimal here. Here means in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And Montana as well. But other than that, the curriculum as an undergraduate was very similar. The curriculum has gone through many changes, and maybe I should talk about that just a minute.
Mm-hmm.
In the 1900s, a pharmacist got a license to practice pharmacy after 2 years of internship under another pharmacist, provided he had taken certain science classes in high school. So after 2 years, you could get a license to practice pharmacy if you had gone to a school of pharmacy and had worked under a proctor, so to say. That gradually changed to 3 years after high school, and not even a high school a diploma. You had to take certain classes in high school, and that was good enough to enter the pharmacy profession.
Mm-hmm.
And that again, so from 2 years it became a three-year program, and subsequently they required that you must or you had to have a high school diploma before joining the pharmacy program. And I believe in 1933 or 1934, it became a degree program. So you got a bachelor's degree after 1934 to practice pharmacy. And that went on for a while, and in 1950, in the early 1950s, things changed, and the pharmacy program for a bachelor's program became a 5-year program. I must say, the University of Montana was the fourth or fifth in the nation, mm-hmm. to switch from a 4-year to a 5-year program, which was quite something in those days. But the reason I went back in history is the pharmacy program in India was already a 5-year program when I arrived here in Missoula in 1967. Mm-hmm. So there was not much of a difference, but being a British Raj when I grew up in India, we were under the British system of education, and the British system paid a little more heed to laboratory work, paid a little more heed to drug manufacturing techniques, which are practiced in pharmaceutical companies. And though we had an inkling of that in the early pharmacy education in this country, that has completely been eliminated from the curriculum. So they used to call it industrial pharmacy. And industrial pharmacy doesn't exist in any school of pharmacy in the United States anymore, though we still do have some of that in most of the European and the Asian schools. Mm-hmm. So that is how the curriculum was different. But as long as we are on the curriculum theme, I might add that in 1995, we changed from the bachelor's degree, 5-year bachelor's degree, to the 6-year PharmD program. And the first graduating class, PharmD class, was 1998-99, mm-hmm. which is a 6-year program after high school, 2 years of which is pre-education, pre-pharmacy education, and 4 years of which is intensive pharmacy education, classes taught within the school. And for those guys and gals who had a bachelor's degree and wanted to switch to PharmD, we had a program which was referred to as an external PharmD degree. So say if you were a pharmacist practicing in Livingston, Montana, with a bachelor's degree and you wanted to get a PharmD degree, you could do that part by correspondence, part by coming to the campus. Mm-hmm. And so we had an external PharmD program which started in 1995 also, and the last of which, the last of the external PharmD class was taken, started in 2003, and that will come to an end now. So mm-hmm. all the people who are in the pipeline of the external PharmD, once they are done, the program is done and finished with. Mm-hmm. The PharmD program as such, where you actually come to the campus and work after high school towards a degree, mm-hmm. continues as a 6-year program after high school. Mm-hmm. So that gives you an idea of how the pharmacy curriculum has evolved.
I'm talking about it evolving, I want to go back, because before we started recording here, you mentioned that the University of Montana's pharmacy program was about to celebrate its 100th anniversary. But then you said in recounting that it was not until 1934 that pharmacy became a degree program. So what was here as a pharmacy program from 1907 on?
Well, I have to go back even a little further than that. In 1905, mm-hmm. in 1905, and I may be off by a year or so, the Board of Pharmacy in Montana, which is a licensing board housed in Helena at that time, and I think still there, requested the Board of Education, which was equivalent to the Board of Regents now. Mm-hmm. So the Board of Education was asked to bring about a pharmacy program in the university of not in the university system. So they approach Missoula and they approach Bozeman to have the program. Missoula said, "We would love it, but we don't have space for you guys." Bozeman said, "We have space for you." So the program started in 1907 in Bozeman. Mm-hmm. And between 1907 and 1913, much before my time, there was a swap. There was an engineering program here on campus, U of M campus, and an engineering program in Bozeman. And the regents, or rather the Board of Education, said this is duplication. We don't have the resources to spread all over the place. So pharmacy was brought here, and engineering permanently moved to Bozeman. Mm-hmm. So in 1913, Dean Mollett, one of the first deans, loaded all his equipment in a railway cart with an assistant and moved to Missoula. And they were given a little spot in the old science building, which I may be wrong, but which originally was where the Honors College is now. Mm-hmm. So the original science building is where they were given two rooms. One room was for the dean, and the other room was the laboratory, the classroom, the whole gamut. Mm-hmm. And so that's how the program moved to Missoula. So at that time, till 1935 or 34, I believe, they gave two diplomas. One was, I believe, called PhG, which is pharmacy graduate, which was given after 2 years of work and high school background. And then they gave pharmacy chemist, pharmaceutical chemist, which was PhC, which was a three-year program, which you got after some courses in high school. In the mid to late 30s, then the degree program was introduced. So does that kind of give you mm-hmm. the little background? Mm-hmm. And in this report, you may find that.
Okay. You know, the other thing I wanted to ask you is, you mentioned that the major difference between Indian European pharmacy schools and American ones when you came was this hands-on approach, lab time. Why wasn't that going on here, do you suspect?
I wouldn't say it wasn't going on.
Why wasn't it as intense?
It was not intense, or I would say it was intense till the 1950s. After 1950s, with the pharmaceutical companies developing at the rate at which they were, mm-hmm. like just to name a few, like Park Davis, Eli Lilly, some of the old pharmaceutical companies of the US, more and more of the medication was available in form of tablets, capsules, suppositories, tinctures, what have you, ready-made. Mm-hmm. So the pharmacists who had to compound in the old days just bought it, mm-hmm. you know, and dispensed it to the clients rather than go to the trouble of making it. So the laboratory technique plus analyzing what you had made became less and less important. It was all done for you mm-hmm. by the companies. And so gradually that diminished.
Right.
But things have changed again. Just to fill you in on it. There is a tremendous surge in herbal products all over the world, but now even in the United States finally. And not all herbal products are manufactured by the big names, big companies. So a client goes to a pharmacist and says, I need a tincture of echinacea. And if he doesn't have it on his shelf, he will either make it or send the client to some other pharmacist who may have it or mm-hmm. will make it for him. Mm-hmm. So there is a rejuvenation, so to say, of the techniques of percolating and making tinctures and so on, which had almost died down to nothing mm-hmm. Till this rejuvenation occurred mm-hmm. In the early 1990s. Mm-hmm. And future pharmacists, if they cannot provide their clients with what they are looking for, will lose business, point one. Secondly, if they are not knowledgeable, it will reflect badly on them. And if you talk to a pharmacist in any drugstore or department store, he'll tell you, he and she will tell you, mostly she now. In the old days, there was mostly men. Now there are more women than men, mm-hmm. Pharmacists, that they'll tell you that at least one third of the questions asked a pharmacist in a drugstore these days has to do with herbal medication. And that is quite something. Mm-hmm. So if I'm a pharmacist in a drugstore and somebody comes and asks me about Hoodia, and I said, gee, I know, I've never heard of that. It'll reflect on me as a pharmacist. Right. So the earlier these guys and gals get on the ball, the better off they will be.
Mm-hmm. So we've been talking about pharmacy in its larger picture in the United States or sure. India and how it was. Talk a little bit specifically about just your job when you first came here, what the department was like, what you were doing, your relationships with faculty, students, yeah. curriculum.
Sure. A couple of things. Again, to look at history for this, when Dean Mollett moved from Bozeman to Missoula, Montana, there were two faculty members in the pharmacy department. One was the dean himself, who was professor, dean, cook and bottle washer, and an assistant. And that faculty number remained more or less the same through World War I. And then during World War II or just thereabouts, the number increased to three and perhaps four. When I arrived on this campus in 1967, we had six faculty. I was the seventh, and the dean was the eighth. Mm-hmm. So there were only seven or eight faculty. Also, I was the first Asian immigrant hired by the University of Montana. Mm-hmm. There were some Asians who were Asian Americans who had worked here, but no Asian immigrant who had been hired before I arrived. So I was looked at with a little bit of curiosity and little bit of doubt whether this guy is going to make it or is he here just because there was a vacancy. Mm-hmm. So I was watched very carefully, not only by my colleagues on campus, but also my own department, my own school, where I had to perform a little more than my buddies in order to prove that I could do it, which you often hear from women these days, where they say, if we want to compete with the men, we have to do a little more than the men are doing to show that we are capable of doing. Mm-hmm. So I was in that sort of a situation.
Mm-hmm. You know, I've heard a lot from people who were hired at that time reminisce about how congenial faculty was, and still it was a small enough school that you knew most of the people on campus. Faculty had get-togethers, very social. Were you part of that? Were you accepted into that?
Yes, yes. The faculty were congenial. We knew everybody on campus by their first name. We used to meet socially more often. We used to have a square dance group, a faculty square dance group that used to meet once a week or once every other week, I forget. There used to be a bridge club. People used to play bridge, and I did go and play bridge a couple of times, but I'm not much of a card player, so I gave that up. I was more interested in the outdoors, hiking and that sort of thing. So, yes, you're right. The faculty was a little more social. People, although in different disciplines, respected each other. There was not too much fight between departments. Off and on, of course, there is, but not as much as it's going on now. And the most shocking part is there is a lot of intra-departmental fighting going on in many departments. Thank God it's not in pharmacy. That I don't believe existed. I may be wrong, but I don't think existed, at least not on the scale it is now. And of course, the most congenial person was President Bob Panzer, who was a real great guy to work with. And I don't know how, but he remembered our name. And George Denison does too. I'm not saying George doesn't. But even after he retired, if I ran into him on the street somewhere, he would know me by my first name. I doubt if all the deans and department chair can do that now, partly because the faculty has increased in number, and partly because that rapport is gone. That rapport we used to have is kind of diminished.
Did it diminish simply because of the size of school?
Mostly because of the size of the school, and each person, each dean, each chair is looking out for himself, I guess more so than they did in the past. And I'm not trying to pinpoint any particular dean, including my own dean or chair. I'm not trying to imply that, but yeah, I think so, generally speaking.
Now, you said that obviously the School of Pharmacy went from a faculty of two, including the dean, to seven or eight when you started. It's continued to grow throughout the years, and it's a fairly large, prominent school. Why has it grown? How has it grown? Who has been behind that growth?
Those are very good questions. Again, without naming names, I would say the previous administrations of pharmacy were satisfied with status quo. After Dean Van Horn retired, the dean I was hired, the dean who hired me, Dean Catafomo came on board. He made minor changes when he arrived. For example, he introduced clinical pharmacy, a new program in the school, and things then again became stagnant, and that stagnancy continued to a point where we were put on probation. And in the mid-1980s, the pharmacy college review board put us on probation. We were not accredited, or we were put on probation with warning that we would not be accredited if certain changes were not made. In other words, we were on the chopping block, and some of us were looking for jobs elsewhere. So Dean Cataforma left for Wyoming. By that time, George Dennison had arrived. And George Dennison, who had left the campus in 1966 after finishing his school here, truly believed in the school, not only the University of Montana, but also the School of Pharmacy. And with support from the Pharmacy Association, the pharmacists in the state, and I would say a lot of guts, he went to the Board of Regents and the legislature, and I believe got an allocation of $400,000 to hire new faculty and bring about a metamorphosis in the school. Plus, soon after he arrived, he hired Dean Forbes, David Forbes. And both of these two guys got together and got the wheels turning to a point where things started to happen. As a matter of fact, I don't mind going on record for saying that when Dave Forbes accepted the job, I told him that you're very brave to take this on, or you're mad to take this job, because, I mean, if the school was without, I mean, if the school closed down, he was without a job too.
Mm-hmm.
Not only this faculty, but the new dean.
Mm-hmm.
So he laughed, of course, and we had a, we talked about it often after that. But nonetheless, what I'm trying to say is, Forbes came on board, and he's a very hardworking individual with a lot of foresight. He hired a new chair for the pharmaceutical sciences department named Vernon Grund. So Vernon Grund and Forbes then took it upon themselves to make improvements. And the ball started rolling. They hired good new faculty with research experience, faculty who had grants, faculty who were able to generate funds, and that has brought about changes that you keep hearing about in the media.
Mm-hmm.
For example, right now we are the, out of 95, almost 95 schools of pharmacy in the country, we are fifth in the nation in obtaining extramural funding from the National Institute of Health, which is no small thing,
mm-hmm.
but because we are a small state, a small town, a small school, and we are shoulder to shoulder with some of the big guys.
Mm-hmm.
So as a matter of fact, some of them envy us.
Mm-hmm.
The large schools envy us for having the resources we do have at this point in mm-hmm. time.
And how big is your specialty, pharmacognosy, in the school and in the world of pharmacy in general? And the reason I ask that is because I grew up in Indianapolis, home of Eli Lilly. I've toured the facility. It's very, well, it's a sprawling underground mm-hmm. facility, laboratories that seem to me very industrial, synthetic. It's almost surprising to know how much of our modern pharmaceuticals still depend on natural plants.
Yeah. That again, I would have to go back in history to mm-hmm. to bring you up to speed on it. The pharmacognosy as a discipline played an extremely large role in India, where I grew up, played an extremely large role in Europe, where some of my professors were educated in India, the professors in India were educated. And so I came with a solid background in pharmacognosy when I arrived. in Rhode Island to work under Dean Heber W. Youngkin, who not only himself but his father as well, were well known in the field. I think we did well. The pharmacognosy went through some changes from the crude drug material. We started making extracts, and extractives were sold. Some of these extractives were worked on to isolate the active principles, and the active principles were sold in form of tablets and injectables. And because we had to isolate these active compounds and study the chemistry, phytochemistry, chemistry of plants, became a very important part of the pharmacognosy curriculum. And during my tenure at the University of Montana, we evolved in that direction, mm-hmm. where in the old days we used to look at crude material, and we gradually from that to the extractives, from the extractives to the naturally found compounds in plants. And we evolved, and evolved fairly well. What was happening at the same time, and I would say between 1960 and mid-1970s, the pharmaceutical industry was going through changes where the synthetic compounds were being synthesized at a very rapid rate, and some of the synthetics, particularly some of the synthetics that had been derived from natural substances, were getting into prominence. So what I'm getting at is organic synthetic chemistry just took off like wildfire. And when that took off like wildfire, less and less attention was given to pharmacognosy, to a point where it was also getting less attention in the curriculum. At the same time, pharmacy as a profession was evolving, and from the derogatory term we hear that pharmacists are pill pushers, the pharmacists were becoming more consultants to their clients rather than pill pushers. Mm. And because they were becoming consultants, a new discipline now we refer to as clinical pharmacy evolved. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, synthetic organic chemistry came up like a bomb. Clinical pharmacy evolved as a new discipline. And so the older disciplines like analytical chemistry was thrown out of the curriculum altogether, because we didn't analyze anything anymore as pharmacists. And pharmacognosy, they said, gee, it's what the Greeks and the Romans used to use. We really don't need herbs and herb potions and so on. So eventually in 1979 or 80, they threw it out of the curriculum. And at that point, I had two choices, to teach pharmacognosy as an elective, or go and find a job elsewhere where they would accept me as a pharmacognosist. So, I would say literally, between the late 1970s and the early 1990s, you can say pharmacognosy died. Mm-hmm. And then in 1994, President Clinton signed an act known as the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act of 1994. which was thrust upon him by nature lovers who were getting more and more interested in natural products. And when that particular act was passed, suddenly pharmacognosy became came in the limelight all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. And things have started to pick up again mm-hmm. in my field. The sad part is, when I retired in 2002, though I do teach, still teach, I was not replaced. So if I drop dead today, which is always possible after 70, there is nobody to replace me.
Mm-hmm.
And some of my colleagues are knowledgeable, no doubt, in herbal products, but they don't have training in it.
Mm-hmm.
And they can read all sorts of books and documents and teach a class, but their hands are not dirty with crude plant material.
Right.
And so I don't believe they have the same enthusiasm, same gusto to teach it as I have.
Mm-hmm.
If I can blow my own trumpet.
Yeah. Well, speaking of blowing your own trumpet and getting your hands dirty with plants, what, you know, you mentioned one of the big revivals of the pharmacy department here, the turnarounds, was research faculty and grants.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit about your own research in your time here. and other significant research that's come out of this pharmacy department. But particularly your own.
Okay. If you talk about my own, again, I would have to go back in history,
mm-hmm.
where when I arrived, we used to teach many classes. Research didn't play an important part. And Dean Van Horn said, if you want to advance and from an assistant professor become a professor, you will have to do teaching, provide service to the community, and do research. And we want you to be involved in research. So, naturally, I said, find me a laboratory where I can do research, provide me with wherewithal to do research, and I'll go to town. The answer was, we have no space for research. We have no money to support you, your research. And what you do will be on your own time. And in those days, we had 9-month contracts. And what he said was, you have the whole summer to do research, and you can use the undergraduate labs to do your research in. What about the money? We have no money. Go and find your own. So, naturally, with no mentor and no funding, it was very difficult to start a new research project. And I struggled. I struggled for a long time. I continued to do research, but struggled. And finally got some money from the Montana Heart Association, got some money from couple of pharmaceutical companies, and did some research, enough research to publish a paper or so a year, so that I would meet the requirements for which I was hired. But my teaching duties didn't diminish any, and the space problem remained till finally I got to a stage where I said, you know, if I have no space and you expect me to just do research in summer, you know, I might as well not do any. And at that point, they asked me to empty out an old room where old equipment was stored, and it is still there in the pharmacy chemistry building, the basement, I had to, with my own hands, because I had no assistance, tidy up an old stock room full of old equipment, old papers, documents, you name it. I mean, it was filthy as hell.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me 2 years just to empty that room, because you can't sell equipment that is obsolete in Montana. You have to store it somewhere. So you couldn't throw anything away. Anyway, to make the long story short, I finally got a lab of my own, which developed through the years. But one major hurdle was I had nobody in the School of Pharmacy interested in working with me on my research projects, because they had their own battles to fight,
mm-hmm.
and their own research to accomplish. So I had to go outside the department. And my specialty was studying medicinal plants through tissue culture means, where you isolate plant cells, grow them in culture in little petri dishes and flasks. And I had nobody to do this work with. So at that time, Dean Solberg, who was the dean, at one time the dean of the College of Arts and Science, and who was a botanist, and I discussed some projects, but when he was a botanist, as soon as he became a dean, in a year after I started working with him, that stopped. And so I had to look for other people to work with, and Dr. Meyer Chesson, who is still around, agreed to work with me on some projects, sent me some graduate students who helped him with his projects, but we started to collaborate. And then finally, a breakthrough came where a fellow by the name of David Bilderbeck, a plant physiologist, decided to work with me.
Mm-hmm.
And a biochemist by the name of Galen Mell decided to work with me. And so we had some small, by today's standards, piddly grants, which kept the research endeavor going. But going to your earlier question, what was the highlight of your research, my research? And I would say the highlight was that for the first time in history, I was able to demonstrate through my research that enzymes produced in the papaya plant can also be produced, the same types of enzymes can be produced in tissue culture, in cultures made from papaya plants,
mm-hmm.
in the laboratory, which by all standards was quite an achievement, but no takers. In other words, nobody who would support that sort of research. So shortage of money continued, and I had to scurry around asking people and begging people for equipment, supplies, what have you.
Mm-hmm.
But even today, I have small research projects going with other faculty who have some minimal interest in plants. But funding plant research, particularly medicinal plant research, is very, very meager on the national level. You have billions of dollars that go into NIH, and I believe out of the billions, I forget what the NIH budget is, but it's in billions. Out of that, about $90 million go into natural product research.
Mm-hmm.
When we say natural product research, it also includes antibiotics that are made by growing molds and bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a fraction mm-hmm. of the NIH budget that goes into natural products. So mm-hmm. that has always been the shortcoming
mm-hmm.
In projects that I have been involved in.
Mm-hmm.
Now the tremendous advances that have been made in pharmacy right now, in the School of Pharmacy, have been in the area of pharmacology, and pharmacology, which also is a discipline taught in medical schools, has the upper hand in research projects. So any research projects in pharmacology, especially pharmacology of drugs that affect Americans, such as cardiovascular disease, diabetes, mm-hmm. stroke, and now, of course, AIDS, that's where the money goes. Very little trickles into the natural products mm-hmm. area. But I'm happy for the guys who have the money.
Mm-hmm.
I'm happy because that's what brought about progress in the School of Pharmacy. Mm-hmm. And it'll continue, but sooner or later, I'm sure we're going to wake up at a time when natural product research will surface to a point where it'll also hopefully mm-hmm. generate as much, if not the same amount, at least a little more money than it is possible to get at this point in time.
It seems surprising to hear that so little money is committed to it when earlier you said, you know, that pharmacists, over-the-counter pharmacists, will claim that almost a third of their inquiries are for herbal products and natural products. And it makes me think of, you know, you mentioned earlier that, you know, you used the term nature lovers sort of pressed this issue on President Clinton. And I associate that with also a time where environmentalism, in a lot of ways, turned its attention towards saving the rainforest. That became a very big issue. And one of the reasons that has always been associated with that is all the plant variety, species variety there. And of course, you can't just say we need to save variety. You have to say, well, it could be worth something to us. And I wonder how, if at all, pharmacist, especially someone in your position with an interest in plants, have had to been involved or speak out in that issue.
Yeah. I'm glad you have that question for me. The rainforests are dying, no question about that. There's no question that medicinal plants, along with the other plants, are being eliminated from the face of this earth even before they have been identified or studied. And forests all across the world, including our own forests in the US, have been cut down for lumber, for ranching, or to grow crops, to feed our expanding population. But the biggest loss, which nobody pays much attention to, is the intellectual property of the people from whom we learned about medicinal plants used by our ancestors. So a very famous ethnobotanist at Harvard who died recently, Dr. Richard Schultes, said...
How do you spell his
name? S-H-U-L-T-E-S, Richard Schultes, said that... And he wrote a very nice article on burning of the Amazon. In it he says, no doubt we are losing forests, no doubt we are losing plants, no doubt we are hurting nature. But what is disappearing faster than all of this are the shamans who have the knowledge And the shamans are being driven away from their own environment. Mm-hmm. The shamans are being pushed into urban areas because they have nothing to live on, being pushed out of their own territory. Mm-hmm. So he says the greatest loss is the loss of the shamans. Just like we lost the shamans or the priests or the what I would call healers, natural healers in Europe, in Asia, and now in South America, the shamans are dying and disappearing at a faster rate than the plants themselves. Mm-hmm. And with it, the knowledge that they have derived over a millennia is disappearing. Something that will never be able to recover again. So you're right in saying that, yes, we are concerned about it. But, and the pharmaceutical company should be concerned about it too. But there is a slight catch there. The pharmaceutical companies are looking for money. If something brings money, they go for it. Otherwise, the shareholders would get a hold of them and the company would go broke. There are two things. One is something that Mother Nature produces cannot be patented. If you cannot patent a plant or a plant derivative from South America, then there is no money. So the companies are not interested. Mm-hmm. That's one thing. The other thing, of course, is that because there is no money, they are not interested. But their money is where diseases that affect the rich is concentrated. Mm-hmm. So, if there was a disease, and one good example is malaria. Malaria kills approximately 1 to 2 million people a year abroad, not in America. So why should the American pharmaceutical companies invest money in finding a cure for malaria when Americans who can pay for the drugs, who can give them the revenue, are dying of heart disease mm-hmm. and diabetes? So, selfishly, in a way selfishly, the companies are putting money where they can earn large sums of money such that mm-hmm. they can tell their shareholders, look, we made so much money. Mm-hmm. They don't care a damn if 10 million Africans or Asians died of malaria. And even if they did find a cure for malaria, they can't afford to pay the modern prices that American drugs demand, American mm-hmm. pharmaceutical company drugs can demand. Mm-hmm. Who can pay $50 for one pill? There are some drugs on the market which are cost $50 a pill or a $50 per injection. When in most of the third world countries, the poorer ones, the annual income is about $300 a year of a whole family. Mm-hmm. How can they afford one pill which is worth $50 when they may have to take 100 of those?
Right.
So for all those reasons, selfish and otherwise, in my opinion, we are not going in the right direction. Mm-hmm. But that's the way it is, and we have to learn to live with it or find a way out of it.
Mm-hmm. So I guess to end, I would, you know, we could certainly talk about yeah. the pharmaceutical industry for a long time.
Sure.
But how I'd like to end is just you, some assessment or memory or recap or things that we've left out that you find significant about your time here at the university.
Well, again, we would have to look at history for it. The school has come a long ways. we moved from Bozeman to Missoula. We had two faculty, one faculty and an assistant. From that, we have grown to approximately 50 plus faculty and about 150 employees in the school. Mm-hmm. In a span of 100 years. Unlike any other school in the University of Montana system, you can look at any college in any of the campuses. None of them have grown this size in this short a time, especially after the 1990s when we were on the chopping block and Dave Forbes arrived and made those changes. Mm-hmm. So that's very significant. Equally significant is the fact that though we were stuck in an attic in the old science building with two rooms, one for the dean and one for the laboratory and classroom, we finally moved in 1938 into the chemistry pharmacy building, which was built in 1938. We shared that with chemistry for all these years, but the bulk of the building was occupied by chemistry. Mm-hmm. In the last few years of Dean Van Horn's tenure, he kept requesting for building funds, which finally arrived, but with a catch. The catch was, we don't have enough money for pharmacy, we don't have enough money for botany, we don't have enough money for psychology. You will have to have a building which houses all three. Well, in the meantime, botany got shoveled with zoology into biological sciences. Mm-hmm. So botany was eliminated, zoology was eliminated, and it all became Department of Biological Sciences. So psychology and pharmacy were left an odd pair. Both, one has to do with mental health, the other with physical health, but we were shoved in the same building, and so we moved from the pharmacy chemistry building to the pharmacy psychology building in 1981. And then after Forbes arrived and he realized that both psychology and pharmacy were full to the brim, space was required, he went out and found money to build addition to the pharmacy psychology, where you see a new part sticking out on the north side, which is known as the Skaggs entrance to the building. Mm-hmm. And the south side, which is the research wing of the pharmacy school. And that happened in year 2000. Mm-hmm. And when he started hiring all these new people we talked about, space was gone again very quickly. And now we'll move into the new addition to the Skaggs building in 2007. Mm-hmm. Another jump of 50,000 square feet. Mm-hmm. Laboratory space. So that's also quite an achievement. So that's one thing we didn't cover. I must compliment both Dean Forbes and Dennison. Without these two, it couldn't have happened. Mm-hmm. And as I told you, in the mid 1950s, we were on the chopping block. We were gone. I mean, it was taken for granted that we were in the last year or two. Mm-hmm. of the school, because we were on probation. And I might add, the presidents in those days, Jim Cook and Bucklew, who were in between, and Bowers did try a little, but between Panzer and Dennison, we had Bowers, Bucklew, and Jim Cook. Mm-hmm. None of them, and I can say that very vehemently, none of them were interested in pharmacy. Mm-hmm. None of them were interested if pharmacy was eliminated. Mm-hmm. You see? So had it not been for Dennison arriving, and had it not been for Dean Forbes arriving on campus, you wouldn't be talking to me today.
Mm-hmm.
So it's as simple as that.
Mm-hmm. But you're going to be here to celebrate the 100th anniversary.
Well, I hope so.
Quite a turnaround.
Yeah, well, I'll be here for the 100th anniversary.
Thank goodness for their short presidential tenures.
Yeah,
those
yeah,
three.
Yeah. And sadly to say, all three of them used this campus as a stepping block to other better things.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the sad part, because many, not only presidents, but deans and chairs often come here to use this as a stepping stone to get to bigger things.
Mm-hmm.
And they're looking out for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They don't care a damn about Montana or the people or the school.
Mm-hmm.
They're looking out for themselves. Once they get to that stage, they're gone. And we are left with nothing,
mm-hmm.
quite often.
Just by the number of years they've stayed alone, Panzer and Dennison seem to be interested solely in the university and
without
the long-term health
yeah,
of it.
Yeah,
without it's any. Not necessarily a stepping
yeah.
stone.
There are lots of complaints about Dennison not doing this or not doing that.
Sure.
And there are bound to be complaints. When you try to do new things, there are bound to be complaints. And I'm sure Dennison has done things that, according to many, were not appropriate things. But at least things were not static. Things moved. Things happened. Both with Dean Forbes is the same thing. Many unhappy people about both of these guys, but they made things happen.
Mm-hmm.
There was progress made, which we cannot say for many others.
Great. Well, yeah. Mr. Medora, thank you for your time.
Yeah, thank
input.
You. Thank you for
it's
asking.
It's been enjoyable.
Yeah.